Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have with me Rob Sheffield and Brittany Spanos, and we are going to talk, inevitably, about folklore. My favorite tweet about folklore, which is, of course, the new Taylor Swift album that materialized from the ether just now. Someone asked, as we all stayed up at midnight listening to the album, someone asked, is this album the vaccine? Rob, you said it's her best album.
Absolutely. It's absolutely the one that so many of us have thought that she would make or could make. Definitely a decisive step into her 30s. Definitely like a thematic and musical statement. Absolutely perfect songs. No duds at all. I think this is the first album without a single skip.
Yeah.
Even Red has, you know, Snow Patrol duet, which I always forget is there because it's not on my playlist of it. But it's amazing that this is such a perfectly conceived, perfectly realized album.
Brittany, is it Taylor Swift's best album? Are you prepared to as well to say that?
Yeah, I think I am. Like, I think that, like Rob said, there's no skips. It feels like such a, kind of in the same way like that we talked about with Fiona Apple's Vegetable Cutters, like it feels like such a product of all the albums leading up to this and feels like such a, like a clear evolution of her as a songwriter, as an artist, a lot of things that she's been trying to prove for so long and trying to get people to understand about her as a songwriter, that, you know, just like her incredible storytelling abilities that kind of always got muddled by like everything around it and all the drama and like, you know, the celebrity of her. And I think just getting to like hear her go for it and tell these stories that are about these characters that she's imagining in her head. And it, I mean, it's just so, it's so well done. And she kind of, she shed a lot of the celebrity of Taylor Swift, the personality, to kind of like go even deeper than ever before.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, just quickly on the thing of celebrity, as Rob pointed out, there are a couple of glancing, amusing references to her fame, but they're framed in a different kind of way. Sometimes it's almost like it's another person. Bad was the blood of the song that you were listening to. The same song, Bald Was the Waitress Who Said, You Look Like an American Singer. It's like lurking in the background, but it's no longer the narrative at all. There's a number of steps forward on this album. Maybe break down the various ways in which she has progressed or even leapfrogged.
Yeah, I mean, I think like there's a little bit of each album in this. So, you know, you have the kind of return to the country twang that people always kind of joke about is the loss of that country twang, but you kind of hear a little bit of that fearless and self-titled era Taylor on a song like Betty. You hear, Speak Now being the first album where it was solely written by her all the way through, and kind of that return to that here, and thinking about Red and that pivot to arena rock and testing out a little bit of the indie sound that we hear more well thought through here, and kind of as a sort of concept all throughout the entire album. All the kind of lyrical references in 1989 and Reputation, that kind of mood that she sets along on a lot of the songs that aren't necessarily the big pop singles, the big, you know, kind of bombastic arena pop sound. When you kind of go to the deep cuts on those albums, you kind of hear that in a lot of Aaron Dessner's production. And of course, Lover, we kind of saw her do a little bit of a mix and kind of a precursor to what we're hearing in folklore with a song like this title track of Lover. But it seems like there's a little bit of each that she's kind of peppered throughout everything up until now.
That's so true. It sums up the best of what she's done before. And with none of her shtick, and you know me, I love her shtick, but she's self-consciously avoiding a lot of the things that people associate with her. As Brittany said, she's not doing the bombastic arena rockers. Clearly, she knew this was a record she was not going to be playing live. And she said, you know, why do I want to do a song that'll make the stadium, you know, rock and like pump their hands in the air and sing along? These songs are not going to exist in that environment. And so, you know, a lot of the things that we usually associate with one of her records, there isn't a single Southern accent. Brittany mentioned there isn't a single English accent either. She's become fond of those. There isn't a single song set at 2 a.m., which is definitely a first for her. And most shocking of all, first album ever where she doesn't laugh at one of her own jokes once, not even once, which is, you know, on Lover, it was like half the songs. A lot of the things that we love and that we look for in her records as continuities, they're fan service in a bit. She's self-consciously stepping away from those.
Obviously, Last Great American Dynasty is linked to the song Starlight from Red, in that one was about the Kennedys. This one is sort of about the same milieu, but with a much more jaundiced and distant and acerbic eye. That song is a real accomplishment. And it's also just, again, kind of showing her hand as a grown-up with a really sophisticated take on things, able to embody the judgment of the society. When she said, you know, new money only goes so far. Just there's a real casual sophistication there and tremendous mastery of compressed storytelling. And then, of course, as someone said, I mean, like, who else would write such a great song about the mansion that they own?
Who else is like, oh, I'm getting noise complaints from the neighbors? Well, let me do a little research. The person who owned this house in 1957, you said the same thing. Great example of her ever awe-inspiring refusal to let anything go. Does not let anything go, does not get over anything, plans these like fantastic details, like, you know, planting the word marvelous in that song, mm-hmm. that a certain element of hardcore fan, including, you know, us, is going to pick up on, but something that she knows is going to go over the head of most people listening to the song. Just brilliant that way. Love that song.
She packed so much history into that song. Like, learned so much within that song, and I wanted to learn more about Rebecca Harkness, and then I was like, oh, she put it all literally in this entire song. Like, it's all here. I mean, it's so much fun, and her breaking the kind of, like, I guess, like, fourth wall of, like, and then I bought it. And then I bought this house. It's just so fun. I feel like her sense of humor has definitely gotten even sharper with how she kind of is able to marry that part of, like, this thing that I was talked about, and, like, people were kind of, like, blaming me for this thing and this was happening, but, like, being able to kind of, like, insert her into the actual, like, full history of this place is pretty, it's just like so fun and so well done.
I wanted to return to the idea that Rob brought up, which is that this is so clearly an album by a huge artist who's aware that she is free for the moment of the restrictions that come with how do I tour this album? Because I think people underestimate the degree to which huge touring artists who are also very active and successful recording artists tend to have to take that a bit into consideration. I was in the studio with you 2 years ago. There was this very interesting battle between Brian Eno in the basement and you two upstairs, literally in the studio, where Brian Eno was trying to get them to make a very meditative, beautiful, emotional album that wouldn't have worked at all on the stage. It would have been U2's Folklore had it ever come out. Whereas the guys upstairs were being like, that's great, Brian Eno, but we literally have to play stadiums and we can't meditate with the crowd for an hour. This is an interesting intersection of sort of like the historical moment allowing someone like Taylor to be liberated from that. And it's the freedom of that, of both that and then I guess a lot of other things. Like, she just, again, didn't have to overthink when to release this, didn't have to think as much about singles. I think you can really feel the artistic freedom all over this album, right?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, what's funny about it is, especially the more I listen to the album, as much as it feels like such a departure from that, like, arena pop stadium mindset, she's just such a great pop writer. That there's so much catchiness in every, like, literally, like, listening to My Tears Ricochet, like, all I want to do is scream that bridge in, like, a giant stadium. Like, you know, like, it's, like, that's, like, stuff like that is, it's weird how it, like, pops up across the entire album, that kind of catchiness and that, like, popness of her, you know, writing brain that kind of is impossible for her to totally let go of when she's writing. Even if it's not necessarily the main goal of it, it's still there, which is so fascinating. But, yeah, it's, like, I feel like it's, she could, in theory, pop in these songs into, like, a Lover's type of, like, stadium setting, which is just, I, you know, most artists, when they kind of strip away this, wouldn't be able to. Like, it would feel like such an outlier amongst those.
Totally. Yeah, it, absolutely. Every time she makes an album, it's so funny. Like, I always think, wow, I hope she does what she did last time. And that literally never happens. Why do I never learn? But that sense of her being able to do these songs that feel so intimate and private and yet so loud and so intense, just a really amazing balancing act that she's got in her songwriting that hardly anyone in history can match. thinking in terms of historical parallels, I keep thinking of Darkness on the Edge of Town, where, you know, the quarantine
It must be said, you're always thinking about Darkness on the Edge of Town.
I'm always thinking about that album, always. But also the step away from, you know, like rah-rah arena sing-along type stuff, not that Born to Run is dominated by that in any sense. But in many ways, the quarantine for her is her equivalent of Bruce driving across the country and writing those songs. There's a certain amount of, you know, the artist as adult, as isolated from fame, isolated from their own day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of breakthrough that she's made here with these sort of third-person character studies that she's always had a flair for, but doing a whole album of them is just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
I think we need to go through and see how we can compare it to each song in the Springsteen catalog, and then go through the Joni, then go through the Joni Mitchell catalog, and maybe Stevie Wonder. Maybe let's just keep going. But
Meet Me Behind the Mall. Oh my God!
Yes.
There isn't a dynamo in that town. So like, no Tasty Freeze in this town. You know, Exxon sign. You know, it's Meet Me Behind the Mall.
But to Brittany's point about the pop that could not be suppressed in her songwriting, it is just extraordinary that on top of everything, on top of the obvious excellence of this album, that it is almost, despite itself, an absolute commercial smash is something I'm still kind of wrapping my head around. Why it did better on streaming than Lover, I have some theories.
I mean, I think that was something that people had sort of been thinking of in terms of like the state of the surprise album, right? Like Beyonce kind of setting the tone with self-titled, and like a lot of artists attempting to do that after, and sometimes it worked, most of the time it didn't. There's a certain level of artist who can give no promo at all. She gave us like just less than 24 hours to prepare, but even that, like, there aren't many people who can do that. And I think that combined with how surprising the sound was and how different it was, I think, you know, for everyone, the Lover era was a bit taxing. There was a lot happening for many months. There's a lot of Easter eggs that we had to dig through. And there's just a lot of things that, you know, it was a very involved promo cycle, even for someone as big as Taylor is, and didn't necessarily even need that much promo for it. But like, I think kind of coming off of that, where it was so big and so colorful and so much, and then to kind of see her return with this like very like black and white kind of minimal aesthetic for Taylor. I mean, still, you know, a little extra, but it's Taylor. But, you know, I think kind of coming off of that, I think people were curious about what it would even sound like. Like, there was no preview. There was no idea of what it could be. There was just like, here are some black and white photos. I worked with the National. Here you go.
I do wonder whether part of it was just a simple practical thing, which is that the moment it was released, it was impossible to listen to it by any other means other than streaming. I mean, we know factually that there were tons of people actually buying the music, and perhaps they were listening to it on their own personally owned versions of it, and that wasn't registering in streaming numbers, and thus it helped perpetuate a narrative that someone like Taylor wasn't actually as listened to as artists who dominate streaming even more. And I think possibly that on a broader level, that narrative has been shattered. It turns out if you strip away the other means to listen to it, at least right away, like, wow, actually, surprise, Taylor Swift is popular. Were we really doubting that? Was that really a question? I would imagine it's tremendously gratifying for her to release something that is in its way sort of blatantly uncommercial and have it become so spectacularly commercial. It's just,
and such like a shift, because she's been such a traditionalist in so many senses of how she perceives her career and how she promotes music, and how, again, being an artist who, like you said, has always done really big numbers with physical sales, and at a time even when it was almost impossible for a lot of artists. I mean, I think of, was it 1989 that wasn't on streaming for the first week around the same time that Adele was doing the same thing? Like,
God, you know, this is such the opposite, but yeah, sorry.
Right. Same thing.
Reputation. Yeah, like that was just a few years ago. And
yeah.
She was very resistant to streaming for a very long time. And it was even surprising, like to the point where it was surprising that Lover was kind of, you know, available on streaming the first night. So for her to completely pivot and be like, you know what, like, I'm just like, not only am I going to forgo this whole rollout, that this traditional rollout that she's always done, even when it was a little bit less traditional with something like Reputation, where she wasn't doing interviews like she usually does or doing other things, but it was still kind of like, here are the singles, here's the visuals, like you have months to prepare. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge, huge shift for her to just be like, streaming first, your physical copy of the album will be here in 6 weeks and this is how you're getting the album, no preparation besides the track list, and here's a list of collaborators.
I could feel Lover opening the doors for the rest of her career. It was a real grown-up album. It had the concerns of someone who was, and the perspective of someone who was almost 30. When I spoke to her, and I don't think any of this made the article, but when I spoke to her for Lover, she had a lot of banter about not being a kid anymore, about feeling, you know, obviously 30 is super young. It's young for the earth. It's not super young in pop. And she was very aware of being an adult, and that joking about how everyone's younger than her, like the photographer for the album is younger than her. Just this thing of feeling like a grown-up. And I think this is even more, this just crosses the threshold even more to, you know, and just like constantly cursing the first line of the album. Hey, if your preteen likes Taylor, this, maybe they don't need to hear the part about the hands under the sweatshirt. But you do. There is that grown-upness, obviously, right?
Lover was definitely a self-conscious turning 30 album. There's a long, great tradition of self-conscious turning 30 albums, whether it's Joni Mitchell's Hegira or David Bowie's Low. It's something artists do when they're as self-conscious and as classicist as she is. So somebody thinks about their music as part of history. And the great ones, they turn and go somewhere new, but they try to sum up where they've been. And Lover was definitely an album that summed up everywhere she'd been. Every kind of style she'd ever tried was on that album somewhere. And this is an album where she's just heading out into the wilderness.
And Brittany, you've grown up with her. I'm curious what that's like.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many lines where she's kind of like, she's looking back on her youth in so many ways, not only through the characters that she's writing. Like, she has so many of these teen characters, and it almost feels like this like side B to the first few albums of like her own teen character. Yes. She's like, here's like, you know, there's so much fantasy and so much, you know, fairy tale-ness to the way that she wrote about teenage love when she was a teenager. And for her to kind of look back and be like, you know, let me write this involved love triangle between three teens that's just going completely sour and is terrible. Like, I think that's such a perfect example of growth, is like being able to kind of like reflect on that in a way that's not with bitterness, but with kind of this intent to add more depth to that idea and add more perspective to that idea and kind of take her own lessons from growing up, you know, 15 years from 15 and kind of looking back on that. But I think of like the song, This Is Me Trying, which has become my favorite. I mean, there's a new favorite every day, but that one's definitely come up a lot more for me in the past couple of days. And I feel like that there are so many pointed lines on that. And the line, I was so ahead of the curve became a spear, like stuff like that, where she's kind looking on this sort of, she's able to reflect on a lot of what she's laid out for herself and her own kind of position in that in a way that's a little less biting than I think she would have done on Reputation or Lover. I think she's able to kind of like look at it now and sort of just like take a step back and be a little more introspective about her relationship with everything.
And before we start going a little bit more song by song, we've somehow managed to not really address the National in the Room, which is just the idea that the Aaron Dessner collaboration and the way in which he brought in other members of the National, the rap on the National, that they're sleepy and for dads and et cetera. And it's just really funny that Rob just made an appalled face. And Brittany can confirm that is a widely...
yes, I did believe the National were for dads. Yes. Until I listened to their last album and I enjoyed it.
Dads, I would dare to suggest, are people too. But there is good music for dads and bad music for dads. It is so funny that she disrupted that narrative, and it's almost like music can't be put into those kind of niches, and the certain opinions are wildly wrong. And maybe if you guys can just talk about what the fruits of that collaboration and what surprised you about it and what didn't surprise you and what worked and et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's clear that Aaron had brought out a lot of kind of this, you know, the way that she spoke about hearing all of the music that he had been working on and like had sent her and she was writing to it and kind of like being able to pair that together. I think it just kind of brought something production wise out of her that was super, I don't know, it was just like very dreamy, like all across it, like everything was just so dreamy and just like went beyond anything vocally that we had heard from her before.
Yeah, such a natural, perfect pairing. I mean, their careers have largely overlapped. I don't really see them as necessarily even being from different worlds, really. You know, High Violet came out the same year as Speak Now. Those were two of my favorite albums of 2010. Both albums that were real breakthroughs in terms of both emotional reach and musical grandeur, and two albums that are both like very adventurous sonically and structurally and creatively, but very like emotionally powerful. And if you've been in an arena full of people singing along with songs by The National, and if you've gone to see The National, that's what you do, and feeling every word and yelling every word and everybody like sort of united emotionally, it's very much like one of her shows. So I think it's kind of a dream pairing, and I think it's remarkably, remarkably natural sounding.
Again, it just shows there's so many lines that people imagine are there that aren't there at all. And also that musicians are better at hearing music than other people a lot of times, you know, because they don't hear these imaginary things that we place into them.
On those old boundaries. I mean, it's funny. Sorry, I made a face when you were talking, when you said the word dad, which like is...
No, like, I wasn't presenting my opinion, obviously.
but it's wild that, you know, that dismissing music as for dads is very much like dismissing music as being for young women. And that like that Taylor Swift and The National, both extremely ambitious, extremely creative artists who don't respect boundaries like that and have no use for boundaries like that. So it's kind of a perfect pairing. Bon Iver as well. Like, that was a really amazing pairing.
Mm-hmm.
A very different sounding register for him. And it just, you know, is this Taylor's best duet, you know, in the history of the Taylor duets?
For Abigail, forever ago. it's way up there. It's weird because it, even for him, his voice sounds really different than usual. Yeah.
Exactly.
The first time I heard it, I thought, this can't be right. This sounds exactly like David Berman and the Silver Jews. And that was like a really strange sort of disconnect. It's even different from like how I thought Justin Vernon's voice would sound in this duet, but winds up being like really, really perfect duet.
There were a ton of tweets all at once being like, is Taylor breaking up? Like, is this a breakup album? Which is a total, total red herring. Do you think that she deliberately kind of planted that red herring as part of the, just part of her artistic thinking, or is that just an amusing bonus?
I think that she, I mean, because her music has been so primarily diaristic and from her perspective, to lead with a song like The One, which is this song that's kind of like mournful of the one that got away after releasing a full album about how she's never been this in love before, is like such a perfect, I mean, and she's always had really great opening songs that feel like kind of a little bit of a nice transition from the last album into the next album. And I think this one in that sort of vein is kind of like a little nod to that, and kind of this idea that, like, you know, so much coming off of such a great love album to lead with such a mournful breakup song. But again, like just it being an album that's mostly from other perspectives, from other characters, it's about this kind of like, you know, from her imagination running wild in isolation. I thought that was kind of like a cheeky nod to kind of the not wanting to tick in just yet to like these characters that she had built.
Yeah, I kind of think it was a deliberate mindfuck in the sense that it was announcing, although she did make it clear in the statement, which she probably didn't have to do, that this is the full break from the autobiographical narrative. She started that break probably with Red, but it feels like part of this is the announcement, I no longer have to follow that narrative strand of my own life at all. This is, for now on, the story, it's a kaleidoscope, it's a mirror ball, and it's gonna go in all different directions. Some things might be autobiographical, but other things might be the literal opposite of what's happening in my life. Does it feel like a declaration of freedom in that sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it kind of, I like sent this to Rob, I think the day that the album came out, but like it felt like Miss Americana, the documentary that came out earlier this year, also felt like the beginning of that break, because it felt like she was purging so many of those demons that she had had as an artist, as a woman in the music industry, as like, you know, a person with very public struggles, with private struggles, with things that, you know, have come out mostly in her music, that have been assumed about her music, have been assumed about her. Like, it felt like such a really beautiful purging of a lot of that kind of seemed like a good break. And I felt like that felt like a beginning of a new type of Taylor and like a new type of freedom that she could feel after that. And so to hear this album kind of be the product of that and kind of come from that like letting go of her past and letting go of her, the things that were kind of sometimes hindering her mentally and, you know, emotionally while she was traversing through her career. But yeah, it feels like it's a nice pairing with the documentary in that sense.
But the song Cardigan, for me, the transition between the end of the verse when you're young, they assume you know nothing, and then into the chorus is just perfect example of utter Taylor Swiftness. The emotional and musical lift there is Taylor Swift.
Absolutely. And also on Red, it was a lost, you know, a lost scarf that she left behind. On her last album, it was a lost glove. This time it's a lost sweater. You know, like her entire wardrobe full of lost items of clothing that she's planted, you know, like hostages, you know, in ex's apartments. Just kind of a glorious sort of, the continuity with her past work is there, but it's a completely forward-looking song. And yeah. Also just the sheer knowledge that like that Brittany was saying that, you know, she posted on social media on April 27, not a lot going on at the moment, like the exact day that she sent this song to Aaron, just evidence that she's always lying and we should never believe anything she says. She looked the world in the eye and lied to us and said, not a lot going on at the moment, the day she wrote this song.
Texted the full lyrics hours later.
Yes. Unbelievable. Knowing that this is something that people would only notice months later. Go back and find.
She can't let go of the Easter eggs.
Unbelievable. The way her mind works. Amazing.
My tears ricochet.
Oh,
gosh.
A song. If I'm dead to you, then why are you at the wake? I mean, that's a bar. That's the ultimate bar. That is so good. I mean, that song, like, of all the songs on the album, I mean, first off, I think it's absolutely my favorite song from the album because I feel like I have to listen to it at minimum 15 times in a row before I can proceed with the rest of the album. But again, that bridge, like I just like, that is such like a stadium power ballad bridge that kind of builds up and it's just so visual and so dark. And it's like lyrically maybe my favorite and sonically, it just sounds so good. And track five, it's always track five.
Amazing. Oh, it's a great track five. Yes. That's a whole album of track fives, basically.
Yeah.
Tears Ricochet. What an amazing song. And also, since we were talking before about her Springsteen fandom, If I'm on Fire, You're in Ashes Too. Good one.
Okay.
This song is just amazing. Like Brittany says, a classic track five.
Mirabal.
So, I mean, like, I kind of love how Cocteau Twins, like, dream pop a lot of the album is, which I think was, you know, like, once we kind of heard who the collaborators were, I wasn't totally expecting that kind of dream popness from it. And I love Mirabal, is just so, her voice sounds so good and it's just so lovely. And yeah, that like August, like those like kind of dream poppy, you know, Heaven or Las Vegas-y songs, I love.
That's really amazing. That's a fantastic reference point for those songs. I was thinking, you know, August for me is such a Cranberries song, such a Mazzy Star song. Her whole sort of early afternoon set at Lilith Fair in 1995 sort of vibe that she's always loved, but
yeah,
it's so perfectly realized in those songs. Mirabal is just such a heartbreaker. And also, I always love when she sings about dancing, you know, as she once sang in one of her ballads, she's not much for dancing, but I love whenever she has such an amazing way to capture the sort of the angsty emotions that can beset you on a dance floor. And this song reminds me so much of New Romantics, which is one of my favorites, but
right. It's
almost like it's the same dance floor and it's just the same scene from a different perspective. Instead of the, you know, club going poser who's crying tears of mascara in the bathroom, it's the mirror ball who's hanging above the dance floor and just watching everybody, taking everybody in, but also reflecting everybody and the sides of themselves that they won't show in a setting like that.
Seven, which is just, I really think, an extraordinary song and so well written. And again, like a really great bridge.
Such a great rhythm. I think that and Invisible String have like, just like really just fun kind of not very Taylor-y rhythms to them. I love those like the little dreamier pop songs that she's doing on this album.
I really love the Please Picture Me in the Weeds Before I Learned Civility. I used to scream ferociously anytime I wanted. It was that vision of Taylor at seven or the narrator at seven is really interesting and also kind of an interesting like the feminist statement and just before like sort of society and or the patriarchy tamed tamed her is that really, 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 really stuck with me.
And her kind of like letting, like the kind of loss of the fairy tale childhood type of narrative from the early songs and kind of the, you know, peak sort of teen innocence that she's reflecting on in a lot of her lyrics about being a kid and about being a teen. There's a little bit of that innocence there, but there's still kind of a slight darkness to a lot of it, which I love, and a lot of maturity to it. Being able to write about kind of from a child's perspective and a very childlike perspective without being too corny or, you know, cloying is really beautifully done.
Well, yeah, I mean, something dark is going on at the friend's house, that there's that whole undertow there.
I probably listened to that song 20 times before I noticed that the song is really about this lost friend, mm-hmm. and just like what a sad song it was. It was too sad for me for a few days. Like it took me a while to go back to it, but just such a powerful, sad song. Apologize for new waving out on you for a minute.
Yeah.
The parallels with Thomas Dolby's Europa and the Pirate Twins, I'll just leave that there. But in terms of like two astoundingly sad songs about childhood friends who like to play pirates and then like, they grow up in different worlds, but just that she never finds out what happens to this friend. There's no circling back. Yeah. There's no resolution to this story. She never even figures out just this sad childhood feeling that follows her around. Yeah. Really just an astoundingly empathetic song and also really like a complex one that just changes over time as you listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, this whole album had me like Hank Hill in that episode where he's like, I think I'm feeling emotions. The song August, which we touched on a bit, but August.
I mean, it's just like a perfect, everything that's like so, I don't know, just the melodies where your voice sounds, like it's just so unlike, like these moments where it does feel like a completely new step forward for her as a singer and as an artist, like something like that, where it's so restrained in a way. And she's always kind of a much more extroverted kind of songwriter and performer, even on her ballads. And so to kind of hear that type of like restraint on a song like this, that's also kind of just like such a dreamy, kind of sad, romantic, you know, ill-fated teen romance song. Because that's from the Love Triangle trio, right?
Yes, like right. Betty, we haven't touched on that.
In August. But yeah, it's just such a beautiful song.
Absolutely. That's another one that I probably listened to it 20 times before I realized, oh, when she's telling the guy to get in the car, it's the narrator of Betty who she's saying that to. She is, you know, the other woman in Betty. But, you know, that these are songs that are designed to still keep giving up surprises after dozens of listens, which honestly, that's the way she's always written songs. Her songs are always full of surprises that take years of heavy listening to reveal themselves. But such a clever thing, because August seems so sad and you're so sad for the narrator of this song. And then you put it in the perspective of Betty and it's like, oh, there's a third person whose heart is getting broken along the way.
Yeah.
And we touched on This Is Me Trying. I think, Brittany, at one point you said that was your favorite song on the album, but you've also said another song is your favorite song on the album.
I have a lot of favorites,
but that's okay.
Brian.
That's okay. That's okay.
I think This Is Me Trying has become the song of the last 2 days that I have not been able to turn off. But I will say that every time I try to play My Tears Ricochet, I literally like cannot make it through the rest of the album without needing to spend like a good hour just laying there, soaking it in.
Yeah.
Thinking about that wake line.
The wake line. Yes. Amazing.
But This Is Me Trying is, it feels
that
like
song
the
destroys
most.
Me.
Yeah. I mean, just like all of the lines on there are just so cutting and so good. And the line about like regretting some of her words and kind of how sharp they've been, like, I think that's, like, there's just so much stuff on there that feels like a little bit more of the more personal side and kind of reflective of, you know, here I am at 30 looking back and out of the, and more so looking at like Taylor as the character. But yeah, I love that song.
Totally. Definitely. My vote for funniest punchline on the album is I have a lot of regrets about that.
Yeah.
So good. It's on the level of In Holy Ground when she says, and that was the first day. That's sort of like, yeah, I know you're saying like, yes, this is totally me at the moment. I get that. This is very totally me. That song destroys me. For me, the album, once it gets to track 8 and we get all in a row, August, This Is Me Trying, mm-hmm. and the extremely underrated, in my opinion, Illicit Affairs. But that's almost to me like, you know, a triptych of like one long song for like 12 minutes. And
yeah.
This Is Me Trying is just such a heartbreaking. The line that you mentioned earlier, Brian, I got wasted like all my potential.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because it echoes one of the most fun boppy songs on Lover when she's, the moon was high like your friends the night
right.
we met. And this is like a very similar kind of pun, but the opposite perspective emotionally. It's like, I got wasted, like all my potential. Just astoundingly great song.
And Illicit Affairs, underrated. Yeah, I guess some people have in passing slapped at that song slightly.
The silence is deafening on that song.
Yeah.
But this mouse will roar, Brian. This song is I think it's a real, real, real deep, like deep hitting song. And it sounds like, you know, she sings about love triangles a lot. This song, in many ways, it recalls like Getaway Car and other songs like that. But
but
just the level of sort of like 30 something ennui with like, yep, beautiful things begin in rooms and end in parking lots. What a line.
A dwindling mercurial high.
Yes.
Don't call me kid, Rob.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. And a song that it's already built up such an like intense emotional momentum. And then like we get to the climax, like, oh, and by the way, and then that gigantic, like, don't call me kid, don't call me baby, look at this godforsaken mess that you made me. It's like there's a little bit of evidence that there might have been a bit of godsaken mess there before.
Yeah.
But the whole level of just the way the song stands on its own as a narrative and how complex it is, and also the way it fits into the songs that it's just come after. It's really just, it's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
On Invisible String, it really got me when she sang Time, Wondrous Time, for some reason.
I have personally decided that the song is about Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham and their Invisible String tying them together.
Wow, okay.
Yes, that's my theory that no one else has.
My God, that's genius. I am so on board with this.
So Lindsey Buckingham was listening to Bad Blood in the cab.
Yeah,
in a way he was, yes, yes.
And
you didn't need to worry about the specifics, you know.
and of course, Stevie Nicks would have been told she looked like an American singer, so that's...
Oh my God, yes. I mean, what is rumors if not Band-Aids don't hit bullet holes?
It does mention change.
Exactly.
LA, totally wearing a teal t-shirt in the yogurt shop.
Time, today. Mystical time. Is there a more Stevie line than that?
Right.
Oh, you are so right. You are so absolutely right.
I'm sticking with this.
Everyone loves, I think, Now I Send Their Babies Presents bit. It's just so...
I know.
You know it's true. You know, it's 100% true.
Well, and as Brittany was the first to notice... A very cleverly timed line in terms of the Taylor X timeline.
Yeah. An X who got 3 albums worth of songs. I will never forget. At least one song across 3 different albums, which is pretty, pretty amazing.
Yes, Sophie Turner got in the mail for her baby a cassette version of Folklore. It's really...
Sophie Turner has the legs.
Yes.
Exactly.
Unbelievable. The level of guile, it is awe-inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, that verse is so good.
Mad Woman has one of the most kind of misunderstood lyrics on the album in the first verse.
Who's long does she smile? What does she mouth? Fuck you forever.
It's a lot more subtle and clever than it could have been. It seems to be back to, it's probably, I don't know, it's at least partly perhaps about the whole Scooter Braun thing, but I could be wrong.
There's so much spookiness across the entire album. Like there is kind of like this, you know, people were comparing the artwork to that film, The Witch, from a few years back, like this kind of like kind of spooky witchiness to the entire album, Mad Woman, and kind of the theme of madness that kind of peppers all of the songs, and especially this being the reverse of a song like The Last American Dynasty, where she's kind of like talking about this woman who's seen as very mad in the town and kind of what she's going through. But there is this kind of like very stirring witchiness to every song. And Mad Woman being the most kind of witchy, you know, she's casting a spell at like 3 a.m. in the middle of the woods.
Someone out there got very nervous when she got to the line about the master of spin has a couple of side flings. Whoa. it's sort of like the song tells you what she's going to do and then she does it. And women like hunting witches too is a great line for me.
Yeah.
And Epiphany is very bold. It's a quick verse, but it's one of the most direct ways in which anyone has addressed our current moment, and it's hard for me to listen to, just about something med school did not cover. That verse is intense, and then it combines that with her grandfather's experience in the military. So there's a lot going on. It's another wild step forward of a song, I would say.
Yeah, and I think we've spoken about this in a past Taylor episode, but she loves a battle. She loves a battle. And I think for her to kind of take the battle from outside of her personal life and kind of put it into this perspective, I think it's just so beautifully well done. And another sign of this kind of like, you know, emotional lyrical maturity over so many albums, but she does love battle imagery. And I think for her to kind of find a way to, like you said, speak to this current time and speak about her grandfather, things like that, like to put that in this perspective, I think was such a bold and great move for her.
And Betty, which I guess they're actually working to country radio, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine it working there. And it's part of this saga, this multi-song, multi-perspective saga about a high school love affair.
Betty is so, so, so good. Mm-hmm. Fantastic song. And again, it's really complex and tricky, even before you factor into its place, like on the other songs on the album that tell pieces of the same story. I think this is the first time that she's sung explicitly from the perspective of a boy in a Taylor Swift song, which means that she does a lot of apologizing. You could tell he's throwing pebbles in at her window. And you could also tell it's outside in the rain when he's standing at her doorway. But like, yeah, completely like phenomenal song, and a way that she takes a very different approach to the kind of story that she just loves.
I truly love the opening of Betty, I Won't Make Assumptions About Why You Switched Your Homeroom. It's just so... That's so good.
Yeah. God.
Very Craig Finn sounding line.
Yes.
A lot of like a lot of the Hold Steady on this album, but Betty is such a like perfect Hold Steady song. I think it's up there with Getaway Car as like
most
Hold Steady-ish moments. But just that great opening line, you know, the middle of the conversation, just, you know, Betty, I think that's why you changed your homeroom. Just absolutely great opening line.
God, you know what that just reminded me of is this, you know, like Chuck Berry was writing about high school experiences when he was 35. And he said something like, I'm 35, but I remember. As Bernie pointed out, and a lot of people pointed out, that to have her returning to this subject matter with the maturity of her adulthood is very pleasing and very effective and very, very surprising.
And she's always loved time travel. She always, even when she was very young, she loved writing songs about old people. You know,
right.
Think of like Mary's Song or You Are in Love, or even a song like Never Grow Up, where she's singing. She knows how painful it is for the mom when the teenage girl says, drop me off a couple blocks from the party. She's always had this sort of cross-generational empathy, and that's really like coming out in her songwriting now. So on this album, there are songs about very old people. There are songs about, you know, little kids. There are songs about teenagers. That aspect of her storytelling is just like expanding all the time.
So what you're saying is that in Taylor Swift's Folklore, she captures the entirety of the human experience.
Yeah.
I could not have put it better myself.
So we're almost done. Peace.
I love this entire song. Would It Be Enough If I Could Never Give You Peace is such a beautifully romantic line and such a Taylor line. So it reminds me so much of False God from Lover, just in the way that it flows. But another underrated gem from the album. I feel like I'm not seeing people talk about peace a lot, and this song always gets me. I think especially that, like, Would It Be Enough If I Never Gave You Peace always gets me choked up.
Absolutely. And Brittany, because I'm still like reeling from your genius theory about invisible strings, is this another Stevie and Lindsey song?
I mean, it could be. This entire album is just about Stevie and Lindsey if you try hard enough and
absolutely
have like brain worms like me, but
this could be her Silver Springs, you know.
Yeah.
Like, would it be enough if I could never give you peace, never break the chain?
I said, I think before we started, that I was kind of hoping that Hoax was taking on conspiracy theories, but it turns out to not do that, but is still pretty great, although not the real ending of the album, as Rob has pointed out.
Yeah, it's wild that people haven't heard The Lakes yet. The Lakes is the 17th and final song on the album. And it's got the last song on the album, Energy, that she loves so much. You know, she loves a big bang end of a song, a very like thematic statement like New Year's Day and Reputation or Begin Again on Red. All her albums have this. Clean on 1989. Just, you know, her last songs are like her track fives. And it's so funny to hear the album ending with Hoax, which doesn't really feel like the end of the album. The Lakes is much more of a summary story. She's going out to the English countryside with her muse, word she uses, and she's singing about Wordsworth. She actually names him. Kind of mind-blowing for me and, you know, my teenage obsession with Wordsworth. I looked at the song title, The Lakes, and thought, wouldn't it be funny if this is a song about Wordsworth and Coleridge? Kind of like the same reaction I have when I saw the song title, New Romantics. And in fact, she is singing about Wordsworth and Coleridge. Sorry, Van Morrison, you now have the second best rock and roll song about Wordsworth and Coleridge. But the Lakes is such a peaceful song, and it's very much in the theme of, you know, that's come in the album of sort of stepping beyond how other people see you and seeing what you mean to yourself and what about your story matters to yourself and what you'll take with you going into the future.
Yeah.
But a beautiful song, very much feels to me like the real end of the album.
Hmm. And basically only Rob Taylor and Sophie Turner's Baby have heard it so far. So it's anyway, any final thoughts?
It's a great album.
Yes. This will be an ongoing.
I love every song. I don't know. I'll have a new favorite tomorrow. I'll have a new Stevie and Lindsey theory probably in the next hour.
I can't wait. Yes. This is definitely like, it's full of stuff, you know, like this is somebody who, like, quarantine, she had a lot of time to like spend inside herself and just sort of like ramble in her mind. And so there's a lot of, this album holds up to a lot of heavy listening and unpacking so far. Mm-hmm. And there's months and years of it left to come.
Yeah.
It honestly already makes me want to hear what comes next, personally.
Absolutely.
Same.
So you have been listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt. I was joined by the great Brittany Spanos and the great Robert Sheffield. And we will be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. And in the meantime, we are, in fact, a podcast. Download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes if you can. We do check those out. But as always, thanks for listening. Stay safe. And we will see you next week behind the mall.